You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Oliver Sacks examines the ability of the human mind to adapt to the world without utilizing the very senses most of us rely on in his latest book, The Mind's Eye. Dr. Sacks is a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center. He's the author of 10 books, including the bestsellers Musicophila, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and Awakenings. His latest is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Oliver Sacks back to our show today. Hello.
Hello again.
This book covers quite a few case studies, including one on your own condition. What is face blindness?
Face blindness is a specific inability to recognize faces, even though one may recognize everything else. It's probably always been around, but it was only given a name. The medical name is prosopagnosia, which prosopon is a face or a mask. Some people have it very severely, and it's not uncommon, but it's really not sufficiently recognized either by doctors or the public.
So what are we talking about, 1 in 100 people, 1 in 1,000 people?
No, fairly severe would be 2 or 3 in 100 people, which
is like
6 million in the country.
Does it occur only when the other person is a casual acquaintance, or would this also happen with your own parents?
Well, it can certainly happen with one's husbands or wife or children, and sometimes one may fail to recognize oneself.
Well, we've met any number of times. Have you recognized me? Do you remember recognizing me in the past when we met in the studio or when we have met at a mutual friend's party?
I remember meeting you and I remember your voice, but I would not recognize your face.
So,
but that is not you. I do not recognize faces.
I won't take it personally, but often at a party, a lot of people suddenly don't remember us and we have to say, "Hi, I'm Leonard Lopate," and then we have a good conversation. Yeah. So it doesn't come as all that much of a surprise. But have you been face blind all your life?
As far as I know, it sort of became a problem when I was in high school and occasionally caused embarrassment or offense when people I just sort of spent hours with, I then wouldn't recognize 5 minutes later.
Is this a genetic thing or is this something that comes as a result of a stroke or a head injury?
Both. The common one is a genetic one. My eldest brother had it, and there's some families where all the sibs may have it and parents. But it was originally described as a result of brain injury or stroke.
But you also say that it could be linked to Asperger's syndrome?
No. I think what I said was that what has sometimes been regarded as my social incompetence or maybe Asperger's syndrome is in fact a misinterpretation of my face blindness.
And some of the ways you compensate for this are having a really good assistant. Kate came in here with you.
Oh, she's my eyes.
You write that other people who suffer from this condition, prosopagnosia, such as the artist Chuck Close, have also developed methods to overcome it. How has he managed?
He is the opposite of reclusive. He is exuberant and extroverted. He instantly strikes up conversations with what visually for him are complete strangers. And he gets to know their work and things about their life. And although he may fail to meet to recognize them 10 minutes later, he can only recognize faces if they are fixed and flat and two-dimensional, i.e. in a photograph.
And there is something ironic in the fact that after he gave up painting abstract paintings, he has pretty much concentrated on doing faces ever since.
Yeah, he's obsessed with faces, and it is very, very amazing.
You write about being in a movie theater 5 years ago, and you noticed that your eyesight was beginning to change. In what way?
I saw a sort of fluttering and glittering to one side.
That wouldn't be a detached retina?
Well, I didn't know what it was. I thought it might be a migraine. Then I realized it was something of the eye. Was it a detachment? Was it a bleed? And I also noticed that some of the visual field was missing. I couldn't see the little lights. And I hoped it would go away. One does hope. But then I went out and it was still there. And I felt rather panicky. And I saw an ophthalmologist that afternoon.
But unlike most people who are panicking and feeling overwhelmed, your first impulse was to write about it.
Not my first impulse, but the impulse was there almost from the start. I can't have any intense experience without wanting to write about it.
And this is something you say is not unique to you. Can you tell us about John Hull?
Yes, he is a professor of theology in England, but he lost his sight gradually and completely, finally, in his 40s, and he dictated a very beautiful and remarkable memoir about what the world was like for him. One of the things which surprised me very much was he talked about losing visual memories and images, that he could no longer imagine what his children looked like, that he couldn't even imagine what a three was like unless he did it in the air.
So that's more than just losing your sight, because many people lose their sight and still can hold on to all of those visual memories.
Well, in fact, when I wrote about John Hull, assuming this was the universal consequence of blindness, I got a lot of letters, especially from blind people, saying this isn't my situation at all, saying that they continue to have vivid visual imagery and sometimes heightened visual imagery after losing their sight.
What was your ophthalmologist's diagnosis of what was happening to you after you came to him from that movie theater?
Well, he didn't quite say what he thought. What he said was, you have something behind the retina. It's either a blood clot or a tumor. If it's a tumor, it could be benign or malignant. Let's talk about the worst-case scenario. But I don't know what he said after that, because I had a sort of voice shouting, cancer, cancer, cancer.
Wow.
And that, in fact, got confirmed a couple of days later.
And in the past, they would have just removed the eye, wouldn't they?
Yes, until about 20 years ago.
That's what Sammy Davis Jr. and many other people. Why don't they remove the eye now?
Well, because using radiation, sometimes followed by lasering, can be as effective.
And that's worked in your case?
Seemingly.
My guest is Oliver Sacks, whose latest book is The Mind's Eye. It is published by Knopf. There are illustrations in this book. Can you describe what it looked like to be losing your vision?
I was very conscious of abnormalities of vision. There was a big pie-like chunk of vision missing. I have an overhead fan with five blades, and I sort of plotted it. I was down to four blades, and then three blades, and then two blades. There were changes in color with that eye, and colors became feebler and feebler. There were distortions, so that horizontals seemed to be collapsing on each other, verticals. And finally, distortions became very extreme, and at one point, sort of, and these slightly infected vision generally, so that people started to be elongated and insect-like, and this grew so intolerable that I would close the right eye or have a patch. And it was, in fact, something of a relief when a further lasering took away all central vision.
Did you feel like you were having hallucinations?
I did have and do have some mild hallucinations, that's to say, involuntary geometrical patterns, which I see, for example, on this blank surface in front of me. Occasionally, if I go into a new place, I'm not sure whether that strange pattern is in fact the wallpaper or something I'm projecting, and I have to go feel it.
Is it true that 10% of the people with impaired vision experience hallucinations?
Something like that. There's a very gross sort of hallucination called Charles Bonnet hallucination, when when things are really out there and you see people, animals, landscapes. And this used to be regarded as very rare, and people don't volunteer information. But I
lost because they think they're going crazy, or they don't want you to know that these weird things are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. But if there's a good, trusting relation with the patient, then you find that certainly 10% or more of people with severe visual impairment hallucinate.
Where does this originate in the brain? Is it in the same places that our normal sight would
Yes,
registered?
The parts of the brain constructing a picture of the world needs a whole cascade of places in the brain which put together things. And if there's no input from the eye, then the visual part of the brain is apt to sort of take off by itself, autonomously, do its own thing. And just as deaf people tend to generate musical hallucinations, so blind people tend to generate visual hallucinations, or a certain number of them do.
Well, when you lose the sight in one eye, you start seeing the world in two dimensions rather than three dimensions. But people have lived with that since the beginning of time. Still, I'd imagine that since we learned to read photography in two dimensions, it might be easier today than in the past.
Well, that's possible, although I should say that I had a passion for stereo photography. And I was a member of the New York Stereoscopic Society, and I think I was probably, very strongly biased towards stereo, using binocular cues and not other cues. And then when I lost the use of one eye, I found myself in a bizarrely flat world.
Do you think that this is ironic in the fact that because so much of your work has been in related areas and now it was happening to you? I mean, you started consulting at Beth Abraham Hospital in the Bronx in 1965, and you were writing about situations like this in your book Awakenings, later made into a movie. But until the 60s, wasn't Beth Abraham Hospital known as Beth Abraham Home for Incurables?
Yes, it had that unhappy title.
I can't imagine naming any place that anymore, but that would suggest that there was also a feeling that there were some conditions that were just incurable.
And certainly one's first view of Beth Abraham then was of chronic disease. People were paralyzed, speechless, whatever. But even if there's not a cure, there are always ways of coming to terms with what one has and living another way. And really, I regard my subject as survival under different circumstances.
And the case studies that you relate here are all about how people found a way to get around what was originally diagnosed as an incurable situation.
Yeah, often very unexpected ways.
Well, but have we also come a fair way in our – well, for example, you were treated – with radiation in the past, they would have had to have removed your eye and you still might have had cancer.
Yeah. We're able to image the nervous system with great detail, and there have been huge, huge strides in medicine and surgery. I've had a few operations in the last year, so I've encountered those. For example, I have a beautiful brand new knee when I had a terrible arthritic one, and that would have been unimaginable 30 years ago.
We have to take a little break, but I want to pick up on this. I want to find out how often neurological disorders are still misdiagnosed, because although we've come a long way, I suspect we still have a long way to go. My guest is Oliver Sacks, who is the author of any number of bestsellers, including An Anthropologist on Mars, Awakenings, The Island of the Colorblind, Migraine, Musicophilia, Seeing Voices, Uncle Tungsten, which are all available now in paperback from Vintage. His latest book is called The Mind's Eye. It is being published by Knopf, and we will continue after we take a little break. ¶¶ We're back with Oliver Sacks. His latest book, The Mind's Eye, is published by Knopf. And before you left, I said I was wondering about whether neurological disorders are still misdiagnosed a lot these days, as they were in the past.
Probably less often. I know some years ago, 40 years ago, when I was a trainee, there would be a special session, a brain-cutting session, devoted to people who had been diagnosed as having multiple sclerosis, and none of them had it.
Well, that's horrible.
Now one can actually image the nervous system in life, and you can tell fairly surely whether they have it or not.
So it's all because of these advances with MRIs and CAT scans and PET scans?
But something like Alzheimer's disease is still mostly a clinical diagnosis. In terms of therapy, the hugest promise, of course, is stem cell therapy, especially for people with Parkinson's and other degenerative diseases. And
but we've yet to figure out how to use those stem cells in a way that actually will lead to some kind of a cure.
Yes, and the research needs to. When I think of all my wretched patients who suffer from Parkinsonism and other things, and how they could be helped, I grind my teeth at the prohibitions and inhibitions of research.
Well, eventually, one way or another, I suspect we're going to come. Yeah. Something's going to come out of all of this. You mentioned Alzheimer's, and you begin the book with a case study of Lillian Kallir, and she has a thing called visual alexia, which sounds kind of like a degenerative disease like Alzheimer's.
Alexia is an inability to read, and she was a wonderful concert pianist. And with her, this came on, first of all, with music, with musical scores. But she continued to give concerts everywhere because she had a huge, flawless memory, and she was just marvelous.
But she couldn't learn a new piece because
she could learn it by
notes?
Ear, but not by eye. And in fact, we were talking about compensation. I think her auditory powers became greater. Some of her visual powers were lost. Then she became unable to sort of read ordinary print and then to recognize people. I don't know that she did have Alzheimer's. She was a very fine, gifted, she was a lovely person. And 99% of her problems were purely visual, although they were slowly progressive.
Well, how did they affect her? You mentioned she stopped recognizing people. How did they affect her relationship with her husband?
He was always recognized. I mean, he was also a fine musician. They used her to sort of concertize together. Well, so she, I think she became more sensitive to voices and also to movement, the way people moved. And she was also able to reorganize her apartment entirely in terms of the color and shape and position of objects.
But you said it was a matter of not being able to read anymore. She could describe certain objects, but she couldn't name them. So does Alexia affect the language center?
Not as such. There were probably some other problems.
She couldn't name sweet and low, yet she referred to it as better than sugar. She should have gone to work for the advertising agency.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, she had insight there. She said, if I can't say it, I circumscribe. And she didn't lose the word circumscribe. Uh-huh. Typically, some of the nouns which get lost, usually first proper names, then unusual nouns.
Well, this is something that a lot of people do when they can't find a word. They just find another way of that they get around it by describing it in some other way. People understand it perfectly well.
I find myself doing it all the while when I miss a name. I remember once at a conference, I met someone afterwards and referred to a book. I said, I forget her name. It's that woman from Toronto. And she said, I am the woman from Toronto.
What about Howard Engel? You've talked a lot about him. In fact, I think you did a piece on Radio Lab about Howard Engel. Uh-huh. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, well, he is a very good Canadian novelist and who has a series of detective novels. But he wrote to me in 2002 saying that the previous summer he had got up, he felt fine, he had breakfast, he went downstairs to get the Toronto Globe and Mail, and it looked okay from a distance, but when he looked close up, it was unintelligible. His first thought was that it was in Serbo-Croat and represented a small publication for an ethnic minority, and then he realized something was wrong with him.
And is it that instantaneous often?
Sorry?
I mean, he went to sleep and he could read, and he woke up and he couldn't read anymore.
Well, he realized he must have had a stroke, whether he had it in the night or at breakfast time. It wiped out his reading. He couldn't read any of his own books, but it didn't much affect anything else. And to his own great surprise, his ability to write was unimpaired, although he then couldn't read what he'd written.
He had to actually draw the letters, didn't he?
Well, he could copy letters, but he developed, and this was not really conscious or deliberate, an extraordinary way around this. Sometimes when he looked at a paragraph, his hand would unconsciously trace the shapes of letters. Mm-hmm. And as he did that, then he could read, because basically he was writing rather than reading. And then his tongue started doing this on the back of his teeth or the roof of his mouth. So he actually reads with his tongue, or he reads by writing with his tongue.
The words, he just spells out the words with his tongue on the top of his mouth, on the roof of his mouth.
Yeah, basically.
A brilliant solution. And he came up with it himself? Nobody suggested it?
Yes, it happened. This is the way with so many adaptations. And he's rolling along. He's written a beautiful memoir of his own condition. He's also written two more detective novels. And there has been no recovery of visual reading in the ordinary sense, or very little. But he has ways around it.
Some listeners have been writing in. Christine in Brooklyn says, I was hit by a truck while walking across the street, and I have a traumatic brain injury. Since then, I've had visual vestibular problems. For example, if my frame of vision is filled with a moving bus, I feel like I'm moving too. The doctors tell me that it's a retinal extinction phenomena or something like that. I get vision therapy at SUNY Optometric, but still no one has explained to me how the brain made my vision make me think I'm moving or falling.
I'd have to think about
that. Yeah, well, but it is interesting that there are a lot of different examples that would fit in with what your subject is here.
Yes.
Perhaps many of them still unexplored.
One of the most amazing, we take it for granted that our visual world is stable, whereas, of course, if you move a movie camera around, it would be all over the place. But for some people, it's not stable, and this may be a little bit the case with this lady.
Audrey in Brooklyn says, I have a good friend who's a famous copper enamelist who is now blind. Despite this, she does wonderful drawings, which she cannot see. And recently I saw a documentary film about photographers who are blind, and some of them are really fine photographers. They have found ways to take those pictures, even though they can't see them in the viewfinder.
You mentioned John Hull earlier, and he describes how, as he lost vision, his sense of acoustic space became greater and greater, and that he could have the feeling of different echoes. And I think we can't do it as accurately as a bat or a whale, but I think one can form a pretty good sound picture, and blind people learn to.
Can we talk about dyslexia for a moment? Because I was once very close to somebody who was dyslexic, who said that when she read, suddenly she would start reading in a spiral, and that one of the ways that she got around it was to take a speed reading course so that and use her finger across the page, But otherwise, she had no control over the fact that she would just start drifting from one line to the next and the next and going around in a curl.
I hadn't heard that particular thing, but people with dyslexia, who are often highly intelligent and very gifted in other ways, may have tremendous difficulty reading at school and indeed as adults.
And often they become visual artists.
Yes.
Is that a form of compensation?
And musical artists as well. I know one very good composer-architect who can't read the newspaper. He can hardly read the simplest sentence. And whether, you know, the brain is different from the start or whether the visual parts develop because reading is bad.
Is there a connection between word blindness and dyslexia?
Yes. The dyslexia is something which is developmental, one is born with. One usually uses the term alexia, as, for example, Lillian had, because reading has been lost as a result of a stroke or a degenerative process, as happened, of course, with Howard Engel.
My guest is Oliver Sacks. His latest book is called The Mind's Eye. In Musicophilia, you wrote about how music therapy may be beneficial for patients with aphasia. How was your patient, Pat, able to utilize a basic vocabulary by recalling familiar songs?
This was a patient of mine at Beth Abraham who really had no expressive speech at all. She didn't go the musical way. She went another way. She became incredibly adept, not only at reading people's gestures and facial expressions, tones of voice, but in her own ability to convey by gesture and pointing. And
she used what she communicated through what you refer to as her Bible.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, our speech therapist. While she couldn't read a sentence, she could read isolated words and knew what they meant. And her Bible really consisted of a lexicon of words referring to places, to foods, to emotions. And she could denote the topic by opening the page, her Bible at the right page, and then really mime things out.
When people read different languages, are they all reading them from the same part of the brain? In other words, if I were reading Chinese or Japanese, would it be from the same language center that a Western language would be read from?
Basically so, and one can now do functional MRI and show what that part of the brain in the left hemisphere, which lights up when one reads a language, whether it's an ideogram language like Chinese or an alphabetic one.
Even though one really has to do with more like pictures, and in the end they all wind up being the same kinds of symbols for us?
Yes, they're sort of very abstract pictures.
We mentioned earlier the whole notion of incurables. In all of these discussions, can we say that the way that these patients compensated for the disabilities can be considered a cure? Or is it just a compensation?
It's a compensation, but a compensation which can transform life and enable one to sort of pick it up in a different way and very brilliantly.
Well, you say that people with aphasia are better at detecting lies, so... Yeah. Is that one of the positive aspects of something that is rather depressing?
In a way, I sort of saw this myself and wrote about it years ago when I saw a ward of aphasic people laughing at Ronald Reagan and not being taken in by his words, but only perceiving the inconsistencies of posture and so forth.
You wrote about that in Awakenings.
In The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. But I think this was regarded as just one of those sack stories until some very good researchers at MIT sort of studied this and confirmed that it was so.
So there, it's not just a matter of us figuring out how to compensate. The brain compensates in odd ways as well.
And spontaneously, one of my subjects who has become blind, he's a psychiatrist, you know, feels he is now more in touch with what's going on with patients by listening to their voice and even by being able to smell them.
Now, why doesn't the brain just simply rewire? Because it does. It has, in some other cases, people get have strokes, yeah. And then the brain rewires, and they learn to read again through just from a different part of their brain.
Well, certainly the brain is plastic, and it does rewire like this, but sometimes a completely different method. I mean, reading by writing with one's tongue has almost nothing in common with it is not a visual process at all. But it is, of course, using a different part of the brain.
Now, we've talked about your condition. You've had hip surgery, and you have near blindness in one eye. Are you still swimming?
Absolutely. I feel whole in swimming, and I love swimming, and I think I'm quite a good swimmer. And so, although I use a stick on land. Actually, that's partly a visual stick because curbs just look like horizontal lines for me, and I could come a crop if I didn't feel it out with a stick.
That's because you're seeing two-dimensionally?
Yes.
I wonder about all those people in the old days, like the film directors, Howard Hawks, who had an eye patch. It was really great for him to direct two-dimensional films, but...
It's interesting that there's been some suggestion that... it's easier to form a visual composition if one only uses one eye. And although I used to exist very much in a world of solid objects situated in space, now to some extent it's a canvas or a screen with moving shapes. And so I wish I could draw or paint.
But in the end, you find yourself being able to compensate because
yes, well,
you made it here without much trouble.
Just about.
Oliver Sacks is a practicing physician and the author of 10 books, including Musicophilia, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and Awakenings, which inspired the Oscar-nominated film of the same name. His latest book is called The Mind's Eye. It is published by Knopf, and it has been a great pleasure talking with you, as it always has been.
And my pleasure, too.